It wasn't until I got this record on vinyl just a couple years ago that I was able to sit with it and to form some pretty deep opinions as to why this record needs to be discussed and why this record needs to be defended. Let's discuss. Hello and welcome back to a new episode of Everything Phil Collins. Today we're going to undertake the big task of reviewing Calling All Stations, a really unique record in the story of Genesis. And that's going to be kind of the theme of today's review, is how this is really just one interesting, very interesting chapter in the entire story of Genesis, a story that goes back decades and has so many different players and different eras. And so today we're talking about what might be considered, or what would have been considered, the final era. But, you know, if you start to think about 2007 and even The Last Domino and perhaps beyond, it really isn't the final era of the band. But we're going to talk about the album. We're going to go track by track. But before we do, there's a lot of context to this record that I think needs to be discussed as part of its defense. We need to really understand the mindset of Mike and Tony after Phil left. Just for a little bit of background, this record, Calling All Stations, came out in 1997, and it only featured Mike Rutherford and Tony Banks, the original members of Genesis. Phil Collins had moved on at this time. He had released Both Sides a couple years earlier and Dance Into the Light. He was now fully doing his own thing. Whoever was to replace him as a singer had some big shoes to fill, although they're probably small shoes, let's be honest. And whoever had to promote this record had a really tough task to focus the public's attention on the music and the new band members without having to discuss that big asterisk, which is, where's Phil? We need to get this out of the way. Anytime that we discuss anything related to Genesis, we need to really acknowledge the benefit of hindsight. Looking back and obsessing over things is what we do best. It's kind of the whole purpose of this channel, but we're able to do that by being really removed from when an album like this would drop, what it would be like to hear this for the very first time in the late 90s, after all of the guys have kind of moved on from really trying to do anything commercially on their own and have set themselves into retirement mode. There's a lot of grace and clarity that comes with that. So any astute opinion that comes out of my mouth, which there won't be many, but any valid critiques or opinions are something I'm only privileged to now with all this time gone. I was a teenager in 1997. I didn't pick it up on release day, but if I was a diehard Genesis fan in 1997, a diehard Phil fan, and I picked up this record, I probably would have had some pretty harsh opinions. And that's natural. Change is tough. That's because we tend to be jaded towards legacy bands. We tend to be more critical of bands that have moved on and romanticized. I don't know if it's a subconscious thing. I don't know if there's truth behind it. Sometimes I find it easier to believe that the band was more authentic and more hardworking and more passionate about the music back in the early Christmas Cottage days, when they didn't have marriages and they didn't have things distracting them and they didn't have any money. All they had was the music and proving that they were good. Does that change when you become millionaires? I kind of feel like it does. I don't know, but I feel like we're always kind of jaded towards bands that have deep catalogs. We always tend to romanticize the earlier stuff. So we got to get that out of the way. We kind of have to acknowledge that bias. But like I mentioned, there's the grace of time. There is less emotion and more clarity as all these years have gone on. Something you wouldn't have had as a fan back then, and something the critics certainly didn't have back then. Let's ask a really big question. Why would Mike and Tony do this? If Phil leaves the band at the commercial peak of their career with We Can't Dance and the We Can't Dance tour, obviously they knew their time in the spotlight was coming to an end. So why not just hang it up there? I mean, Tony even wrote Fading Lights as the last track on We Can't Dance. So why not just end there? Well, aside from the obvious, which is that creative people just like to create and most people don't want to retire, look at Chester Thompson, there's three reasons why it made a ton of sense for them to keep going. Like, a ton of sense. Number one is they've lost a singer before and it turned out okay. And not just any singer, a singer who wore interesting costumes, who contributed to a lot of the lyrics, a singer who the band was just essentially known for, someone with a great voice. And what happens after they lose this iconic singer? They get bigger, more popular. So could that happen a second time? Could they lose an iconic singer and start again with a new, even bigger singer? I mean, there's precedent. The other thing is that every time a band member leaves the band Genesis, with the exception of Phil, the band gets bigger. the band gets more successful. Band members have left this band many times before. And every time they do, when they think it's going to be the end, like Ant Phillips or Peter Gabriel or Steve, they're more successful. Isn't that weird? And the other reason that Mike and Tony probably decided to move on is because they probably thought, hey, we're the common denominator. We've been in the band since the very beginning. When Ant leaves, we continue to be successful. When Peter leaves, we continue to be successful. When Steve leaves, we come out with a hit song. So maybe when Phil leaves, we can keep doing it. I mean, Mike had been really successful with Mike and the Mechanics. So maybe they just thought we're the core of the band, that it doesn't really matter what singer we have. Now, I'm not trying to accuse them of being arrogant. It's actually true. They're the founding members. They're the common denominators of all those decades before. So it's a good assumption. Now let's talk about why this record should have done well. The biggest reason, and I can say this with authority as being a teenager in the late 90s, but this record sounds exactly like that era. It sounds exactly like the mid to late 90s. It was the evolution of grunge, not just to rock, but to sensitive singer-songwriter rock, pop rock, if you will. Make a playlist from that era, from the era when this came out, and who would you include on that playlist? You would realize really soon that all of the popular bands and popular songs sound a lot like this record, and vice versa. Bands like Collective Soul, Tonic, Matchbox 20, The Wallflowers, Radiohead, U2, Creed, even Sean Mullins with the acoustic guitar, Eve Six, Soul Asylum, Counting Crows, Our Lady Peace. This grungy, we used to call it shop rock because it was like the music the guys in shop class listened to. So there was every reason for this record to be successful because it sounds, when I put it on, this was a couple years ago, I put it on the turntable and I hadn't listened to it for a really long time with the exception of Congo because Congo was on the Greatest Hits album and was on some other playlists I had. But to listen to Calling All Stations, the opening track, even Not About Us or Shipwrecked, I was like, man, this takes me back to Collective Soul. I listened to a lot of Collective Soul back then. It takes me back to Tonic and Soul Asylum, like every like cool rock band. And there were just so many. And like, I know that there was urban stuff happening and there was Britney Spears and Backstreet Boys happening at that time. But if you weren't into that, then like the alternative rock that was happening, like stuff that was like a little bit like more accessible than Radiohead or Marilyn Manson sounded exactly like Calling All Stations. So I really think this should have been a successful record for that reason. In fact, I think this record would have been super successful if the record label had been fully behind it and if they came out with a completely different band name. If Mike and Tony just kind of snuck in the back, they kept Ray Wilson to the front, it would have just been another Ray Wilson project with songwriting from these great historical, successful songwriters. It's the Phil Collins asterisk that really messed things up. If you were judging Genesis and Calling All Stations through the entire Genesis profile, if you were judging it against Invisible Touch or you were judging it against The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, then that's problematic. But if you just judge this album based on the other albums that were happening in the late 90s, I think it would have done really well. It should have done really well. Now, that's not to say it doesn't have problems. We're going to go track by track in a couple minutes, so stick with me. I just think it should have done really well. But it didn't, because the record company didn't know what to do with this record. And that's because of Phil. Really, Phil is to blame. I mean, it's not his fault. He left the band. There's an interesting story. I think he told John Edgington or he told somebody else about how like the guys sent him a CD copy of this record and he just put it in a drawer. He couldn't bring himself to listen to it. And I think he finally did like one night with a scotch, listen to it. I can imagine that being kind of emotional. I feel like you would be critical of it no matter what. Maybe he imagined himself singing the songs, which we now have AI to do, which is hilarious. But Phil wasn't involved in this record, but we still have to kind of blame him for the lack of success because of the press, right? The press just could not, and the record company as well, could not figure out a way to talk about this record or to promote this record without saying, oh, by the way, it doesn't include Phil Collins. You almost think nowadays, with all the album features we have, that Phil should have done a feature on this. He should have played drums on The Dividing Line. That probably would have helped it sell way more records. Of course, he didn't want to do that at the time, right? He wanted to fully remove himself, but that probably would have helped the record a little bit. Kind of like a veteran quarterback, you know, like passing the ball to a rookie quarterback. I think there was a lot of hope that the name Genesis would just automatically sell copies. And we know that is true, but it also would have been interesting if this band was just called Tony and the Tonics. I don't know. I also want to say before we get into each track that the decision to go rock as I've already mentioned, was a really wise decision and almost a return to form for the band. I don't think they would have been received at all if they had done that middle of the road adult contemporary sound, a sound that Phil was doing on his own and a sound that they kind of dabbled with a little bit on We Can't Dance. And even the early 90s, that sound was becoming a little bit rejected from the younger audience. So to try to continue to do that in the late 90s would have just been a death sentence. So I think it was a really smart move to go in this Creed sounding rock direction. There's two other things I want to talk about. I want to talk about Ray Wilson, because this whole story is really the story of Ray. And one of the things I've noticed from chatting with a lot of you on Reddit or on Facebook or in Discord or in the comments of these videos is that Ray is equally the hero and the victim of this story. And there's a lot of love for Ray Wilson, and rightfully so. And everything I love about this record has a lot to do with Ray Wilson. And everything I enjoy about this story and telling the story of this third era of Genesis has to do with Ray and the interesting thing about Ray. And I love that Ray is still doing great music. He's still doing Genesis songs. And in my opinion, he's an important part of the Genesis story. And I hope a video like this really highlights how underappreciated he was as a frontman, and how some of the just horrible things that just having to carry this torch and having to replace Phil Collins is insane. And I also want to talk about why it was a really good decision to go with Ray. What were some of the other options? Well, instrumental? No, I'm joking. Probably a more common option for the band would be to look for a legacy artist who maybe wanted to be the lead singer of Genesis, who was maybe almost as big as Phil. Someone like Sting. Sting was free at the time. Or Robert Plant. I mean, that's maybe where they started, is looking at some big legacy artists who wanted to take over. That could have been kind of cool. Maybe they called Peter again. I don't know. But they didn't do that. And I think it was very brave and bold of the guys to go with someone who was relatively unknown, although on the rise because he had a hit single. But in America, he was relatively unknown. And I think that's a really good decision. I also think it's good that they didn't go for a Phil Collins imitator, that they didn't find someone who was flashy and poppy. They didn't try to trick anyone by finding someone who had a voice that sounded like Phil. If anything, maybe they were looking for someone with a little bit of a scratchier voice like Peter. But like I've mentioned already, Ray's voice and his overall aesthetic matched what was happening at the time. He sounds like Rob Thomas. He sounds like Scott Stapp or Collective Soul. And he was successful in his own right. Now, I'm not going to tell his whole story. He's told that before. Whether he regrets doing this or not, whether he should have continued his career instead of trying to do this. I mean, if anybody got a call from one of the biggest bands in the world saying, do you want to be our lead singer? It would be incredibly hard to say no. And I'm sure a lot of you will discuss in the comments about how the way that this band just disappeared and evaporated and didn't really let Ray know, it was kind of a dirty way of ending things. But we're not going to talk about that here today. We're going to celebrate Ray, and we're going to celebrate this record. The worst part about Ray Wilson, and it's honestly, it's probably the worst, it has nothing to do with the album Calling All Stations. And I think he would 100% agree with me in saying this. But the fact that they made him sing the old Phil Collins songs like Invisible Touch or No Son of Mine, that is just so cringe. I get it. Like, honestly, there was no right way to answer that. Because if you're doing a tour, people are coming to hear Genesis, they're going to want to hear Mama. They're going to want to hear No Son of Mine. I get it. They're going to want to hear I Can't Dance. But I mean, in hindsight, and again, totally acknowledging hindsight, they really should have, and I know they did this, they did this a lot more than they did with Phil, but they really should have abandoned some of those big singles, which maybe would have upset some people, especially if they did a tour in America. But they should have stuck more to like the deeper catalog, The Lamb, which sounded good with Ray, In the Cage, Mama sounds good. But any of the pop stuff like That's All or Invisible Touch or Hold On My Heart, I feel like it would have been bolder for them to say, we're not going to do that. We're just going to kind of reinvent ourselves and play some of the older tunes. But I just find when I look at videos and I see Ray singing Calling All Stations or Not About Us or Shipwrecked, it's just works. It works as a trio. It works really well. But then when he sings No Son of Mine, it seems like he's in a cover band, and he knows that. But really, I don't know how they could have done it. I don't know how they could have done a live show without playing any of the hits. Okay, let's move on. Oh, we have to talk about fade outs, right? Because a lot of people put an asterisk on this album about fade outs, specifically Congo, the album version, and Calling All Stations, the song. There are a lot of fade outs on this record. There is a guy, I got to give a shout out to somebody on Reddit. A couple of years ago, it kind of did an analysis about all of the fade outs in all of Genesis songs. And actually, if you look at the percentages and count every time they've done a fade out at the end of a track, Calling All Stations isn't necessarily out of the norm. Now, Tony has addressed the fact that because they didn't write with a drummer, that they never wrote an ending to a lot of these songs. But my biggest issue, and we'll talk about this in the songs, my biggest issue with the fade outs is that they fade out while there are lyrics happening, while somebody's singing. And we talked about this a little bit in our recent review of the song Congo. And it does it in Congo as well when we are introduced to this new song at the end of Congo. And we're hearing these new lyrics and this new melody we've never heard before, and the song's fading out. Usually when fade outs happen, there's a guitar solo or the band's just jamming out the progression, or the vocals might be singing ooh-ah, or just singing a chorus that we've heard millions of times, like the radio version of Congo, the Take Me to the Congo. We know those lyrics, so fading out seems natural. It's just weird whenever there are, like, it sounds like Ray singing a verse or singing something we need to hear and the song is fading out. I think that's why people don't like the fade outs on this record. Okay, let's talk about the first track, Calling All Stations. Now, make sure you stay to the end of the video because I really want to know your comments. I want to know your thoughts. I think a lot of you will have some big opinions about this. I'm excited to hear. The distortion, that gritty distortion in the Calling All Stations track, probably from Mike, but it could be a synth through a pedal as well, is really cool. I really like this song. This might be my favorite song on the record, Calling All Stations. I've heard that from a lot of people. A great ambiance. I think probably my favorite thing about this album is the ambiance, the synth pads that are happening. I know that's a lot of people don't like that, but I'll tell you why in just a little bit. But I like the ambiance of this record and of this song. It's a great chorus. It's kind of a non-chorus in a good way. That's what I really like about it. It's not super catchy. It almost feels like a bridge a little bit. I think it's really good. Really good tune. One of the themes that we're going to talk about throughout this whole record is almost every one of these songs, you kind of ask yourself, should this have been the lead-off single? I'm sure it's something that Mike and Tony and the record label have pondered over the years. Knowing that they went in the rock direction and not the adult contemporary direction or not the pop direction, could this have been a lead-off single? Would this have done well? Especially when you put it in the context of those other bands I mentioned at the beginning of the video, that could have been interesting to have this as a single. It's a very dark and ominous song, as is with the rest of the record. Another thing that I think Tony and Mike need to be applauded for is that they went in this dark and spooky direction. This song reminds me of Tonight Tonight a lot, maybe even a little bit of Driving the Last Spike. And then the fade out we've just talked about. Okay, second song is Congo, and we just did a review on it. So I'm going to kind of regurgitate some of the stuff I just talked about in this past week's review on the song Congo. The lyrics, you know, there is a theme of this record. You hear loneliness and alienation, I think, is, and it's represented right in this cover of this person standing in space or on the ocean. Is it Jesus? I don't know. All alone in the dark, and then Calling All Stations. You know, we have these songs like Calling All Stations, and then we have the Shipwrecked, what kind of like talk about a person who's lost and alone. And Congo, in a weird way, does actually fit that mold because it's about someone being sent away. And I think the reference to Congo here in the song title is referencing like a Timbuktu, like a just somewhere far away in the jungle in an unknown place. So one of the things we talked about in the song review is the fact that we have 2 to 3 songs happening here. And we know that Mike said that he had 2 songs. And so if we take away the radio edit, we just focus on the actual album version, because there's another song that happens in the album version that we don't really hear in the radio version. So the album version is about 40 odd seconds longer. And we're hearing this melody that is written to the intro. So the intro is this piece that Tony wrote. It sounds kind of African and tribal, probably where they decided to get the Congo theme from. And so we have this vocal melody and these lyrics that are sung on top of this melody. And so you have this kind of weird African intro, then it hits the grungy rock song. Then when that resolves, we hear what sounds like a second bridge, because the other thing I love about this song is the bridge. The bridge is really, really good. Into my heart. It's like one of their best bridges ever. And usually, like, I don't like Genesis bridges. Jesus, He Knows Me, I think that bridge is really dumb and ruins the song, where I actually think that this bridge is better than the song. So we're now going into like what sounds like a second bridge. So it's like a third melody in the song. And we realize it's a callback to the intro. So I said this in the song review. This is what I think they should have done. I think there's three options. And option number one is what they did. Option number two is creating two separate songs. I think that would have been really great because both are really good. I like the main core of Calling All or of Congo. I like that Take Me to the Congo, I'm Free to Leave. That is really good. But this new melody is also really good. The third thing they could have done instead of making two songs is they could have made one long epic song, which would have made this not a good single. And I don't think it was the best single in the first place anyway, but they could have made one long epic song that has the intro, then it has the calling all the Congo part, then it has this new African tribal song, and then maybe it calls back again or it comes up with another thing. So maybe we have like a 10-minute piece similar to Driving the Last Spike or similar to Supper's Ready or The Musical Box or whatever. So we could have done a kind of a longer drawn out Genesis song because it's not uncommon for them to squish songs together. Okay, I like Congo. It's good. Really good. Okay, next up is Shipwrecked. We got to get going here. I think it's the best single on the record. It was a single, right? Yeah, it was a second single. It was released at the beginning of December, so I feel like that's like a death sentence for any new single because it's Christmas time. It's after American Thanksgiving. But this would have been a really great single to lead off with in the fall. Again, I think it's just in line with what was happening at the time on radio. It was kind of like acoustic, sensitive singer-songwriter-based rock music was all the rage in the late 90s. And so Hootie, Counting Crows, I mean, I just think this really should have been the lead-off single. It would have still been considered pop, but not Phil Collins pop. So I think, and it showcases Ray's voice the best. And it goes back to this pattern, right? We're seeing lyrically, send me out to the Congo, out to sea. Is anybody out there? Alien Afternoon. Okay, so this is interesting. We're again with this X-Files theme. There's a cool synth intro in this song. This is definitely a great Tony Banks album. The lyrics of this first verse, I mean, this is like the end of the song is a million times better than the beginning of this song. But the lyrics of the first verse is really rough. And then the refrain, gotta get to work on time. That bothers me so much. I think it was probably the first time I ever heard this album. When I got to this track, I shut it off. Because I think I'm loving everything up till now. But the first half of this song is just really rough. You know what? The sister song to this that reminds me of this is We're Sons of Our Fathers from Phil Collins. Because the first half of that song is goofy lyrics. And then it turns into an incredible song. It's just mind-blowing. The true chorus of this song is really good. Not the best by any means, but it's a good song. It's like a phenomenal U2 style song that's buried in here. I think it's a hugely missed opportunity. I don't know, you know, like I don't know if this record really could have just stood for like more time. Not About Us, that's a great tune. Again, a million examples of acoustic rock from that era. Dave Matthews, Matchbox 20, Hootie, Wallflowers. Acoustic sounds a bit weird to me. I don't think it's not a great sounding acoustic. It's not like a full-bodied Neil Young sounding acoustic warm. It sounds kind of harsh and tinny. And the playing isn't that great, in my opinion. Maybe that was intentional. Not that I'm saying they should go back to like having this been like two 12 strings with Ant or anything, but it just, yeah, it kind of takes away from the intro a little bit. This is kind of, what's that Mike and the Mechanics song? It kind of reminds me, maybe Another Cup of Coffee, maybe? I don't know. Anyway, it's a good song. It makes for a good single. You know, is it a great Genesis song? When I say it's a good song, I mean it's a good song for the era. It's exactly what you would expect to hear on the radio at the time. Is it good when I rank it up against Mama or Stagnation or you know what I mean? It's a good pop song. I think it was the right decision for them. The same thing with If That's What You Need. It's a beautiful song if you like We Can't Dance. This to me must have been like a throwaway from We Can't Dance. I do really like this song. It kind of pulls me back to that We Can't Dance style era, like Never a Time or Hold On My Heart. There's great verses. I love the falsetto that Ray does on this tune. Could this have been a single? I think this could have been a single. Really, I do. I think the problem is that it would have been the second or third, or maybe the third or fourth, because I think it probably would have reminded people a little bit too much of We Can't Dance, middle of the road, a little too much Phil Collins. I hear so many U2 influences in this album, and I'm curious if that was present. I mean, U2 were really hot, and U2 were a really great example of like a band from the 80s who are evolving into a newer sound or kind of like transitioning well. And so, I mean, this was just slightly before pop or just around the time of pop. And so I hear just a lot of U2 in this, especially with Ray's voice. There's a B-side from this record. We might not have time to talk about the B-sides, but there's a lot of them, but there's a B-side called Run Out of Time or Running Out of Time that it's just a great sounding U2 song. And I'm not saying that as an insult. It's a beautiful song, should have been on this record. But I think If That's What You Need kind of reminds me of this later era U2 as well. Might be one of the best songs on the album. Okay, now we're going to talk about The Dividing Line, which is the prog song. It's like the modern prog sound, and it actually sounds a lot like the prog that's being made today, in my opinion. The drumming is very Phil sounding. You know, obviously, I think they probably wanted to appease some of those big drum fans. Could have been cool to have a Phil cameo here, maybe. Great instrumental in this tune. Very flavors of Fading Lights, I would say. Perhaps this song could have been an instrumental. I don't think the melody does anything special for me. So this could have been an interesting Brazilian type end of Fading Lights instrumental for this record, in my opinion. Uncertain Weather, what do you think about that song? That's pretty cool. Cool double vocal thing happening there. That lower range for Ray is really nice. Reminds me of some of the B-sides too. Remind me of Sting as well. This song kind of reminds me of a Sting track. Great drums, a really nice key shift for the song. I want to say I'm a fan of the 90s synths. And now I know a lot of you aren't. I know a lot of people don't like the Tony Banks synths on this song. And 90s were a weird time for synths. In fact, when we had the original synths in the 70s and then the FM synths of the 80s, and then there were no synths in the 2000s. And then now we're all just kind of reusing all those super cool analog synths from the 70s and 80s. But the 90s is like this dark era for synths because everything went digital and they were like, hey, look at all the sounds we can fit on this card. And they were super expensive and everyone was about showing off this technology. Whereas now technology is about how close can we get to the old sounds. And so for that weird reason, I'm really nostalgic to the synth sounds of the 90s. I have this old Yamaha or Roland. It's a roll. I don't know what it is, but it's a 90s synth. And it has just these classic both sides sounds on it. And I don't know. I find it really nostalgic. Like I'm not as nostalgic to a Moog or even to like a Juno synth as I am to some of the 90s sounds. So for that reason, I kind of like these big swelling pads that are on this record. I know a lot of you don't like that for that reason, but for me, I like the 90s synths. It warms my heart. So Small Talk is a tune from Ray. Ray got to bring some of his songs. Ray says it's like Sledgehammer, which could be kind of true rhythmically a little bit. For me, the chorus is not too memorable, but it's better than the verse. Like I'm okay with this song. Like I'm not huge. Honestly, I think there are so many great B-sides on this record. It could have been a single, but not really. I mean, it's one of the least popular songs on Spotify based on the plays. Although props to the field recordings. I really do like that bridge with the talking in the background. I like that experimental sound. I just think from a melodic standpoint, it's not overly strong. There must be some other way. Again, I think the best part of this album is the soundscapes. I said that from the very beginning, and that's just my opinion. The ambient sounds, the synths, the guitars, the kind of things that are pushed back in reverb, which gives you like that visualization of the album cover, right? This empty, huge empty space of blackness and these like never-ending ripples. And so there's a lot of like space and reverb on this record. That's something I really do appreciate. Whereas We Can't Dance was a little bit more up close and tight sounding. So props to Nick, because I really do like I like that sound. It's so hard to know when you write a song in the moment if it's a good tune. And this, There Must Be Some Other Way, sounds like a classic song. Now, is it a great song? I don't know. Would it have been a good single? I don't know. But if I'd written this song, I would have thought I'd stumbled upon a really great hit song just because it sounds like a classic tune. But as a music fan, it's okay. Like it doesn't really give me goosebumps. So I don't mind it on the record, but I don't love it. There's a keyboard sound on the end. You can let me know. It sounds like Fading Lights, or maybe it sounds like Way of the World. It's kind of like that, I don't know. So One Man's Fool, you know, I did a list of the best Genesis closing songs, and a lot of some of you suggested that I include this song. And I think that's probably for the back half of it, right? The double time and kind of that refrain that gets repeated. And I do think that is really good. I maybe overlooked this song for that list because I didn't include it. I think the first half of the song is not as memorable, but when it gets into that kind of more exciting ending, it is kind of cool. Good for them. You know, so much of this review and so much of this album is positive, but with an asterisk. You know, there's always these really great moments on songs, but then there's these questionable moments on songs. And I find that to be kind of a repeating theme. Again, this is just hindsight. I heard that Tony said that this song was written for Phil. That's kind of cool. Anyway, it's fun to go through this record. I dropped the needle on this record yesterday morning, sat in my living room and played through it the whole way through. It's not, this is three sides here, not side four. There's just an etching on side four. But I got to listen to it all. It was beautiful. And nothing, any negative, anything I can say about this record here has nothing to do with Ray. I mean, I think Ray is fantastic on this record, an incredible voice, an incredible dude. I think the story of Ray, as I mentioned before, and the invitation to join Genesis as one of the biggest bands in the world, and then how all that evaporated in seconds. It's one of the most interesting stories in the Genesis world. Unfortunately, it's a bit of a sad one. And I feel for the guy, and I honestly am grateful to him for this record. Do we include it in the canon proper? Yes. Is there a giant asterisk next to From Genesis to Revelation? Yes. Is there a giant asterisk next to this record for fans? Sure. But the evolution or progression, if I can borrow that word without getting murdered, the progression of Genesis or the story of Genesis, not the Adam and Eve one, that's what I live for. That's what keeps me interested. That's what forms the basis for these videos and these reviews. And my record collection is a testament to that. Small Creeps Day, Geese and the Ghost, A Curious Feeling, Face Value, Calling All Stations. They are all part of the Genesis story. Thanks for watching, and let me know what you think about this album. I'm so curious to read your thoughts and your experiences and your opinions and what I missed from this record. Now, we did forget to talk about some of the B-sides. I know there's a lot. There's some I really don't like. There's some I really love. We'll save that for another video. Thanks for watching. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and hit the like button for exclusive videos, behind-the-scenes content, and to have your say on future topics before I film, have a look at our Patreon page. Thanks for watching.